this is tape number three, side number one of the interview with Glenn Bjork. And this is taking place on September 1st, 1994, at his home on Moss Street in Nagani. And my name is Mary Tippett Andes. Glenn, it's been a while since we talked, and we've had some things going on in between. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about that we wanted to pick up from last time was the forge as you were sinking shaft on the Matterby.
Well, you hold it, yeah, better. I might shake. No, we had a double-deck skeleton cage. We were on the skip road side putting in runners. And we had a forge on the upper deck. And one man would keep the rods. We called them hot rods. It was a piece of steel, probably a 3/4 inch round or through. Well, anyway, he'd heat those up hot, white hot. So if the bolts didn't line up, they were to go through the shaft runners and into the steel, we'd put a hot rod in and burn the hole so it'd make the bolt fit. So that was the that was what the forge was used for. And I think I mentioned to you about coming up and getting runners when it was so cold out. Did we mention that on the tape? I don't know. Well, anyway, they managed to put runners in the coldest months of the year, January, February. And when we come up for another load of runners, it was so cold out there, our wet rubber suits would freeze stiff like a board. We couldn't wait to get back on the cage and go back down under. Yeah. 28 feet long, the runners were. 8 by 10, 28 feet. Big piece of timber. They're all from the West Coast. Western fir. Yeah, they used to kid that the freight on those runners were more than what the runners cost from the West Coast. Yeah.
Do you have any idea how much each runner weighed?
Oh, gosh, that's something I couldn't guess that, really. I couldn't guess the weight of them. No.
Now, I don't think, in fact, that we talked about the runners on tape. Tell me about installing the runners and what they were for.
Well, the runners were installed all the way down from surface down. Those are the guides. What the skips traveled on. The skips, there was two in each skip road, and it would keep the skip in line. In other words, it kept it straight up and down. Same with the cage road. There was four runners for the cage road. It made a better riding with four runners, and it kept it straight. Straighter than Matterey was. That was kind of crooked, I guess. No, that was the reason for them, to keep the cage and skips in line, going straight. And they had to be replaced now and then. They get worn bad. And we used to go in some shifts, extra shifts in the summer, vacation time, and work in the shaft repair. We'd put strips, hardwood strips, and they were already drilled holes in them so we could nail them where there was a lot of wear on a runner. Then we'd put these hardwood wear strips to build that runner back up again, you know, to the width it was. Yeah.
You mentioned also that we talked about the skip road and the cage road and the ladder road going down into the shaft. What else went down into the shaft?
Well, the air pipes for to run all the compressed air machinery underground. And there was also water went down for the drilling machines, wet drilling, and whatever they needed water for underground. And then there was all the electrical power cables in the ladder road compartment. And there was a counterweight went down. A counterweight was a balance for the cage. In other words, that helped to move the cage up and down with a load. When you went down with a load and came up, the counterweight helped pull the cage up. And then there was, water and air I mentioned, electrical, counterweight. I guess that's about it, I guess. Yeah.
When you were installing the sets, how did you plumb them?
The engineers plumbed them. We just hung the steel, corner studs, and the sets. And if we had poor concrete, we poured concrete. That was done with the engineers. Done that on a weekend most of the time when the mine was down, when we weren't sinking. But there was a round disc that hang in the corners in the shaft, and they'd run like a piano wire. It was real good wire, and they go down and take measurements from the set out through that wire. It was like a plumb affair. So they'd keep that in line. If there had to be a correction, they would make that correction. In other words, they might have to send down a little shorter corner studs for one side or the other side, or either end there, to bring it back on plumb. So that was the engineers. They kept a close check on that.
I understand there was a lot of pride about how straight the shaft.
Oh yes, you bet there was, to keep it going good and straight. You bet. Yeah. Well, they're right on. I mean, plumb as you can get it. Well, it had to be. We couldn't have knuckles in there. You'd have an awful ride if there was knuckle there. You'd probably have accidents probably with the cage and skip if there was any sudden knuckles in there.
What's a knuckle?
Well, that's where maybe you'd be going down straight and then the runner would be offset a little bit. Like a bent knee, a leg, you know, it'd be bent a little bit, so it wouldn't be true, it wouldn't be plumb. It had to be plumb. Another thing I failed to mention too when we were sinking shaft, I forget the distance, but I think it was about every 200 feet we put in what they call a bearing set. See, you're on surface in this collar is where your first set of steel was anchored. That had to anchor all them sets as you're going down. What was I going to say here now? We're talking about
a bearing set?
Well, a bearing set, yeah. I think it was every couple hundred feet they put in a 6x10 I-beam right across the shaft on the ends and in the center to help support the weight of all them sets above. Yeah, so I think it was every couple hundred feet they put in a bearing set, it was called. We had to blast in a few pops in the side of the drift or the shaft to make room for that, for those sets, or bearing sets. And they were generally put in, as I remember, where an umbrella set would come in. The bearing sets then would be concreted right into the wall and right in with the umbrella set. So they were there, good and solid. Yeah, they had to carry a lot of weight, you know, a lot of set. 70 feet, 30 sets, 210 feet. I suppose every 30, that's a lot of weight, every 30 sets. Yeah.
You said you had to blast in a few pops. What does that mean?
Well, let's drill a few short holes into the sidewall and blast a little bit light so you don't disturb any corner studs. It was just a way of making room. I drill the holes and blast pop instead of a blast. It's just a pops. They call them light blast, stick of powder maybe, or half a stick or something. But it had to go in there 3-4 feet to make a good anchor for that bearing set. Yeah.
So was the bearing set cemented and bolted into the side of the shaft, or how was it attached to the?
As I remember, the center one went right underneath the center divider, and it carried it right under. But on the ends, it had to be bolted through the corner studs. Because you couldn't get underneath that because your corner studs were hanging there. I think that end ones were bolted, as I remember, on the end of the shaft.
Define for me a stuttle.
That's the vertical piece of steel angle iron that's hung each time you put a set, you put a corner stuttle. In other words, that was a piece of angle iron about 8 inch and about a half inch thick, and I suppose about 8 feet, as I remember, 8-9 feet. That's what carried the next set. When you put in your wall plates and end plates, your steel set, that carried that. So each time you put a set, you had to put the corner stuttle first to carry that. In other words, it's like building a skyscraper. You put the corner stuttle upright and then put in the steel sets. So it was like a skyscraper going downwards, going down to the devil. Yeah, it was interesting work.
Yeah. Tell me about umbrella sets.
That was a set, every other set they put in an umbrella set. That was a set that was, they'd send down shiplap and 2x4s, and everybody would build forms. They were put in on probably a 45 underneath that umbrella set, underneath the set, I should say, the steel set. And then they were 2x4s put in. They had a special rig there that anchored onto the steel where you put the 2x4s down in through, and then a wedge or two to hold them there. And then you'd continue on by laying the shiplap inside of that. And when that was completed, and a drain pipe put in on each side, 2-inch drain pipe, I think they were, then the cement was poured. That came down in a big barrel of it, like a tub, and it had a door on it, and you had chutes, just like you see them pour cement around on the surface here on jobs, where they got a little ways to go, they put chutes, so the cement goes. We had chutes there too, that bring the cement anywhere in the shaft, you know. Sometimes you had a shovel to help it out, move it along, of course. But that, when that was filled up with cement, or I suppose it within an inch from the top of the set, you'd keep it at that height, about an inch, so water wouldn't run spill over the set. It had to be a little bit below the set. Yeah. So that was an umbrella set. Concrete set completely. And then every other set, we drill holes alongside the corner stuttles. And in the center, there were some upright, smaller angle irons. We drill holes for reinforcing rods. And then we put clay bags in behind them, concrete bags full of concrete. That would help steady the hole, the shaft in line too. Yeah.
Did those concrete bags remain in the shaft?
They stayed there. Yeah, they set and they stayed there. What used to amaze me a little bit is we pour concrete today and tomorrow they'd be blasting against it. They had some agent in there that made it a little quicker setting. See? Yeah. Then you could pull off all the old shiplap and, yeah.
Tell me about dog drift cuts where the levels would be as you were sinking.
Well, when we started, yeah. It seems though it always came to be where they wanted to start a level. We were always hanging below the last set. There was a crosshead up on the cable, and it went down through. There was an offset there. I forget. I think that was called part of the crosshead too, where it would land on the last set, this piece, and then there was two row cables went down through that part of the crosshead, and it would keep the cage from swinging. In other words, if it was just the cable has a twist a lot of times. And that would hold up fairly straight with those cables going down through there. We used to set a block, four blocks on the steel blocks on the last set, and this rigging would set on them four blocks, and then down through there with the cables would go down through from the crosshead and keep that. But it seemed to me we're always below that when we started a level. We'd have to sprag that cage, that piece of pole, and wedge it in tight both sides, because when you got the drilling machine on there and the air leg, you would be pushing. Even if you didn't, you'd be pushing by hand, your cage would be swinging, see? So that had to be done, had to be spragged, and then you had to hurry up and drill your cut so you could be done with it by the time the miners in the bottom were done too, so we don't want to haul them up. So then that blast would go off at the same time as the bottom, as the shaft cut. Yeah.
Now, so there were simultaneously a crew of guys putting in a dog drift to establish a level while another crew of guys was working below you?
No, it was just your crew. You had 10 men on the crew. Excuse me. But it seemed as though my partner, Paul Paris, and I from Gwynn would always get called on to do that job. The Sprague guy said the other eight would do while we were doing that, two of us. So Paul and I drilled most and blasted most of those start off on the level dog drift cuts, and yeah. So that was detonated same time as the bottom.
Now, when you were doing the cuts for the dog drifts, how far below you was the bottom
shaft? I suppose that must have been 20 feet down there, below that. Yeah. Maybe more, 25 feet, 28. No more than that. I think that's about all the length of those cables were on that crosshead. It wouldn't go any lower than that. So sometimes I know when we got a little bit deeper, you get down, crosshead would come down, and there'd be no more rope on the crosshead rope. Alignment ropes, I suppose you could call them. We'd have to stop maybe a couple feet, 3 feet from the bottom, because you couldn't go down anymore until you're drilled and blasted, and then the dirt pile is raised, then you could get onto it. And then by that time you put another set, so then you'd come down again, so you had play there again. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were talking about suspending the cables off of a block that's like a block and tackle block as opposed to a block of wood?
Yeah, a block is like a shiv. It's a piece of steel with a wheel. Steel plates on either side. They made a lot of them at the mine, snatch block they called them. You could open them. There was a little ring on there. You lift it one side. It was hinged on the bottom. You lift it up or on the side, one side of the block. It was hinged. So you just unhooked up that ring there and open up, put your cable in and lift up the block, and it was all set to go. They manufactured two real good blocks manufactured, Timken and different other ones, I can't remember, Joy. Big head blocks for scraping blocks, and that's a block, yeah. But I, you know, another thing was interesting, I thought, too, when the shaft, if there was a lightning storm and we were charging, we got out. We all got out of the shaft, so a storm went by. And I found out why. We were down there sometimes mucking. We were hand shoveling. When there was an electrical storm, you could feel a little tingle in the shovel. Yeah. Little tingle in the shovel, you know, when you get in the water, and the lightning, ground, it hits ground, you know, close to ground. So I did know firsthand what they're talking about. A little tingle. Yeah.
Now, when you were sinking the shaft, there was more than just local interest in what was happening here, was there not?
There were mining men from different places. I remember there was engineers from England came here. And there was also engineers from Anaconda Copper out in Butte came here to see the operation. And of course a lot of the local troopers and engineers came over to visit it too. And see the operation. I remember our captain was George Colonel. He used to interest me. He was a nice old fellow. He used to come down on day shift and look things over. And he told me one time, you know, Len, he couldn't say Glenn. He said, you know, Len, poor cousin Jack. He had about 40 years in the mine at that time, and he told me time and again that, you know, every time I come down here, I learn something new. I thought, boy, that's something for a man with all the years. He said, I see something new every time I come down. A lot of them people, you know, they get a little bit top head, you know, and they know everything. But he always said, I always learn something new. I thought that was pretty good. Yeah, and we had a good foreman too, a good lead man, Charlie Beslow, a good boss, very good boss. He was right in there working with us. He had trouble at work. Yeah, we had a good crew, real nice, good crew, got along with you. They all did, but I mean, I can only talk for our own, you know. Yeah.
Now, altogether, I don't know if we talked about this on tape or not, but altogether, how long were you working on shaft sinking?
It was about 3 years, yeah. We started in the fall of 47 and then went through 1950. In the 50s we began putting the runners in, you know. Yeah. So it was a 3 year job, mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe 1,000 feet roughly a year, I suppose. Yeah.
Do you remember once the shaft was complete and they were ready to start mining, was there any kind of a ceremony or any kind of a commemorative thing that you remember happening?
No, I don't. That's funny. I don't remember anything about that, unless they had it when we were on maybe night shift or afternoon shift. There could have been some sort of a ceremony, but no. Well, even that holding through that time into Monterey, that wasn't no big deal. Nobody made a big deal out of that. Yeah, I know since we went out in the pit and worked, when the Empire started, shipped its first order, they put a Christmas tree on top of the pile. Maybe they done it in Monterey too. Maybe they did it, but that was on surface. Yeah, after we got done with the shaft, like I told you, I think, or we talked about, it was all this work of cutting out the plats, opening up the doggers bigger and longer, and then opening it up, big drift. And then come back on the skip side and open all that up and blast, cut the trenches out and pockets, and that all had to be done. And after that was complete, then we went inside and started our cross cuts. 6,061, 62, 63, 6400 cross cuts. Six level. That's driving the drift off of the rock into the ore body, see? Cross cut is called. Yeah. You asked me so one time too, or somebody asked me about shaft sites and that. Cliffside knows that a lot of exploration drilling long before they put a shaft on. And I think that was one of the big reasons. They wanted to know there would be a good shaft site, a good ground. And also they knew then by where the hanging rock was and the foot rock by doing all that exploratory drilling. And they always try to keep the shaft in a good ground, much rock as they could. And then their main drifts on the level were kept in rock, mostly as much as they could too, in rock. As the foot rock came down, foot and hanging rock, like that, each level of them, well, they started at the same point from the shaft, but then they cut out to the south more they could keep into that rock drift. And then the cross cut into the ore body. And then after we were cross cuts, drove cross cuts, and then it was cutting top timbers. That's where we'd drill and blast, get in another set of steel on top of that steel, and then start drifting off of that for scraper transfers, scraper scraping drift. And after those were in, then we went up with short raises, 25. Well, we were in a sub-level caving there at the start. I went to block caving later, but the sub living, we had three subs. 25 feet, then we drive adrift and go up another 25 feet and drive adrift, and another 25 feet up and drive adrift. So you're 75 feet up there with the last drift up. But then you, I think I told you about we cut a slot. That's about half of the block. I suppose about 200 and some feet between crosscuts too, maybe 240 feet. But anyway, right in the center on them three elevations, those three subs, we drill long holes on top 30, 40 feet, and then come down and knock out that piece that was in there, and then come down to the bottom one and knock that out. So you had a slot to stop. In other words, you had a big hole open. So when you started your long hole drilling, you had a place to break that ore into. That's the way that worked. And then that naturally, as it got bigger, the ground would cave more by itself. See? Yeah. A big operation. Yeah.
Something just occurred to me while you were talking about finishing the shaft and putting in the plats and things like that. When you finished with something major like sinking the shaft or completing getting the plats put in, mm-hmm. did you ever feel any sense of letdown that such a big, unusual job was done? Did you miss doing that kind of work when that was done? Or did you just kind of think about what was going
on? No, I just thought ahead what we're going to do next, that's all. Yeah. I remember there for a time, talk about like pay too, we made $3 an hour on a sinking shaft. It was good money for that time. And when we were done sinking, we started cutting plats. That was a little slower work at the start. There was no big chance to make contract drifting there. So they paid everybody $2 an hour, $2 an hour, no matter what you done. So yeah, it was good.
Tell me what a burn cut is.
A burn cut is when they drill, there's different, I only tried one in my life, a burn cut. That's when they drill, well, there's three hole, four hole, five hole burns. You drill those holes as parallel as you can, say drilling 5-6 feet in, a cut 5-6 feet. And they had one in the center, one hole in the center. Now, all these outer holes then would break into that one hole in the center. And then your other holes, naturally, as you got them timed by dry or by electric, you time the hole. Yeah, I never cared about the burn cut myself. I saw one burn cut happen at another B, and they rolled up about three sets in the shaft. I think I told you about that time. That fellow came from Vermont. He was after Cap and the super about putting burn cut in the shaft. He said, that'll pull good. And they were hesitant about it. It took them quite a while for Cap and that to go along with it. And so they did try it. And when we went down after that blast, there were three sets rolled up, three of the bottom sets. So we always used to kid this guy about the Vermont cut. How's the Vermont cut? Reno. Yeah.
Of course, the guy had to be Finn, too.
Yeah, he was. He was Finnish. Yeah. But we had a needle about that Vermont cut. There's a Vermont cut. Lost time, no sinking. Had to change all that steel. Yeah. You know, one time, I'll tell you about it, Lon. We're down there. 1,500 feet, maybe. It was in the winter time. You can picture the shaft in your mind and the cage. And on the end of the cage was, well, I suppose maybe a foot or so between the cage and the steel sets. You had to have room there to get your sets off. So there was left about a foot or so on each side. But it was in the winter. We were up on surface and made the blast. And after it cleared, we were going down. But we took little shovels with us. We stopped about six sets maybe above the blast. And guys would get off on different different sets to clean out the channel on it, because it would fill up with dirt. Fine dirt would fly. The little shovel they made out was about a 4-inch shovel, cut out of a regular shovel. But this one particular day, it was all iced on the edge, and we had two cables, or two chains, was across each side of the cage.
Tape number 3, side number 2, continuing with Glenn's story.
Well, ice had formed while we were up there waiting for the shaft to clear out. And ice had built up on the edge of the cage. And we got down to the point, we were down within about 3 sets from the last set down, and another 25, 26 feet, whatever, to the bottom, to the blast. I stepped over this chain to climb onto the steel set, and I was gone. The ice, it was iced on the edge. Both of my feet went from under me. And there I was going through the air. This was on the east side of the cage road. East side. And where I wound up in the middle of the shaft on a divider. How I got there, I couldn't tell you. I must have been doing some scrambling. But anyway, I fell 21 feet from this point on the east side of the cage, and about going through about a foot or so, and landed another 5-6 feet away from where I slipped through there, and I landed on the last, caught the last with my hands. I caught it with my hand. They were all cut, my hands all cut. And I was bruised on my side. And yeah, that was quite an experience. Everybody was peering down over the cage. I wonder where Bjork went, if he was on the bottom. But I was hanging on the last set, so they got me off of that set. So they took me up and examined me. I went back to work. I figured the best thing to keep working, keep that blood. It was pretty black and blue, that left side. But I didn't know broken ribs either, luckily. But yeah, that was quite an experience to get from one place over to another. You're just going through air, you know, through space, like more or less. But you must have been grabbing, see, you're grabbing for anything. I'm pulling my spoon. And went from there, then I went all the way over there, another 6 feet, and that's where I caught hold. Yeah. Well, I suppose those days there, a man wants to make the money too, so I didn't want to stay home. But I thought it was good for me to keep working. Maybe that blood was better to clear up my system working than staying home. I guess that's why I got a 40-year no lost time accident, because I was too poor headed. I guess. Yeah. I don't play that experience.
Tell me how far it was from the set that you grabbed onto down
to the muck pile. I suppose that was 20 feet, another 20, 21 feet, maybe 25. I can't remember exactly. Yeah, it would have been another, 27, 21, 42. I suppose I took a ride about 40, 50 feet, you know, that way. Yeah. Yeah, that was quite an experience. Another time we were mucking in the shaft. I always mucked on the north side of the shaft. That'd be the side towards Teal Lake, under the cage side. I drilled and mucked on that side, shoveling. Of course, when we got to Riddell, then we were all over with the clam. But the skip sides, they always kept kind of covered with sheet iron. For protection, you had protection from the cage, naturally, on the cage roadside. You had that, and then you had a bonnet above the cage. That's a big piece of steel that's clamped onto the rope. It's called a bonnet. But anyway, we had the cage more or less for protection there, too. But this one particular time we were mucking and the cage was up for some reason. And somebody dropped a 5 foot drill rod. That's about a 1 inch steel, 5 feet. Came through the air, tumbling. And it hit me across my back. Lucky it didn't point for a spot when it went through me. But it hit crossway just below my neck and knocked me to the ground. Locked me on the ground. So the guys picked me up and took me to surface, called for the cage and took me to surface. And it was kind of black and blue, but outside of that, I went back, kept working. Well, you more or less had to. You get a gunshot, you probably wouldn't go back. So I kept going anyway. Lucky. Good Lord was with me. What do they say, guardian angel, eh? Mm-hmm. I suppose. Yeah.
So this is probably a little part of where patience and perseverance figures in. Tell me about that a little bit.
Patience and perseverance. Yeah, there's Cousin Jack for came over from England. They were mining partners. And they blasted and they had a mess in their place. Timber down, poles and lagging. And the shift boss came in there. And they were disgusted. And the shift boss told them, boys, he said, you got to have patience and perseverance. And your partner looked at you, oh, who is patience and perseverance? One Cousin Josh looked at the other, he said, that's the men on the opposite shift. Patience and perseverance. Yeah. If I can get this straight, there was another story they used to tell about Cousin Jacks came over and they were living at a boarding house. And the lady at the boarding house would always put up the dinner pails for them. So they decided that one dinner pail was enough for between the two of them. So they said, okay, so she put up one dinner pail. Come time to eat, each had a nice sandwich to eat, a nice piece of cake, and always some fruit. Well, she had put apple dinner that day. And so this one fellow finished his cake quicker, so he took an apple to eat. And his partner all of a sudden he got kind of sullen, he didn't say much. And of course, partner one was wrong. Well, he said, I guess I gotta tell you. He said, you know, he said, when you finished your cake, you took that apple. And you took that big apple. How come you took that big apple instead of the little one? He said, if it was me, he said, I'd have took the little apple and gave you the big one. He said, I know that's what you do. That's why I took the big one. So that's the way it goes. Yeah, I know what you do, partner. He said,
This looks like a good place to get into the description of put a little devil and punch it. What is that?
Oh, sure, yes. Little Frank was in, he was minor over at the Mather. They were bringing up a raise. Making mill raise. Oh, they had a few rounds of cribbing. But then they had to go naked, not without cribbing. It was a mill raise. They'd have cloned them out after anyway. So anyway, they trimmed down good, and you trimmed down good. And then you want to put stage poles for drilling the next cut. So the miner up in the raise would pick a hitch. They put two poles across, one on the hanging side and one on the foot side of the raise. And put fir planks, 2-inch fir plank, to drill off of. Anyway, the miner made his hitches for the stage pole, and he gave his partner the Angelo Melli was his partner. He gave him the measurements with the measuring sticks. Miner's measurements, that's two pieces of sticks that you can put in between wherever you are to get the right measurement. Stretch them out, you know, differently. Well, anyway, he gave Angelo the sticks and he said, "Hey, partner." He said, "Put a little devil, punch it." "What did you say?" He said, "Put a little devil, punch it." "Put a little devil, punch it." He told him about 3-4 times, finally it dawned him what he meant. He said, he meant put a little bevel on the ball and point it a little bit. Put a little devil, punch it. That was kind of amusing to me. Yeah.
Tell me about a hoist man hanging on the cage to make it too heavy.
Oh, sure, in the shaft. They brought up an old hoist from the Gwynn District for the Mather B sinking. It was a good sized hoist, but it needed two big electric motors to make it strong. Although, to make it more powerful, but the depth we were at, it would still handle it with one motor on this hoist. And as we kept sinking, going down the shaft, of course, you're getting longer and heavier and a longer pull. And what was his name again from Gwynn, Lefebvre, he was hoist man on this particular shift. And he would be sweating there, the guy stones after, because he could hardly get that cage to come up. He had to nurse it to get that cage coming up. Well, we got to find out what the trouble was on that, so we were kind of playing tricks on all the Lefebvre there. So when we had the car loaded on the cage, we knew a couple hundred pounds more, they wouldn't lift it. So we used to grab a hold of the cage and hold it down for a while, you know, and then we let it go, and then the cage started going up slow. But it just took a man or two, just that extra weight, so he couldn't lift that load. Yeah, we kind of funny, eh? Terrible guy, eh? Yeah.
Did he ever figure it out?
How was that?
Did he ever figure it out?
No, and I don't know if he was ever told about it. I don't think. No, I don't think he was ever told about it. No. But like I say, we found out how all the Lefebvre was sweating on her trying to get that cage lifted. And so we thought, well, this is our chance now. We're going to play tricks on him a little bit.
Tell me about Jim Hodge.
Oh, Jim Hodge, yes. You know all Cousin Jack stories, eh? We got no Swede or Finn stories or nothing. Well, I told you one, our little Frank Azzitti, that was an Italian one. And I told you about the one with the dinner pail. That was a Cousin Jack. It was a Cousin Jack story, too. They came over to this country, Cousin Jacks, and they came to this area, and they got into mining, and his boy got a job too, and the father naturally took him to break in his boy mining. He showed him how to drill and blast and put up timber and scrape the dirt. And he said, after the blast, there was a couple of bootleg holes, missholes. And so the old Cousin Josh told his boy, he said, "You see there," he said, "those are called a Jim Hodge." He called it a Hodge, he said, "Hodge. That's called Jim Hodge." "Okay," the boy said. Well, they cleaned out the hole and reloaded it and blasted it. But next day they had drilling and blasting again, and they blasted and they were out eating their lunch. And Cousin Jack told his boy, "Go and look, see how it looks. Have a look, me son." So the boy come running back all out of breath. He said, "What's the trouble, my boy?" Well, he said, "It don't look too good, Pa." He said, "Jim Hodge is there and the whole family." And all the holes must have rifled out. They didn't have enough opening, not enough cut holes, I suppose. Not enough opening up. Yeah, here's another old story. I know a lot of them, but you can't always remember all of them, you know. Yeah.
You said something about bootleg holes. Give me a definition of a bootleg hole.
That's a hole like the rifle's out, and it doesn't. I think a bootleg hole is a hole that didn't go off. I think really that's what that is. This other one is long AS. You know, yeah, holes didn't break. They didn't break, so they left maybe a foot or two or three, or even longer if the blast didn't go off right. Cut the holes in all the other holes, they left a long wall. Yeah. So, ordinarily, if your cut opens up, good cut holes and good helper holes around, everything works all good. I think I told you about that bag of powder on the breast that time, too. Every hole works so good that those hitch holes lifted out nice towards the center, and it hadn't it, it would have blew that bag of powder, actually. Yeah.
Can you give me a definition of rifling out?
Rifling out is when there was too much ground for that hole to break. Your charge was in there, but it wouldn't, what took is least resistance. Instead of blowing the ground, it rifled out the hole. Just like a rifle bullet would go, see? Rifle out, yeah.
Tell me about, while we're on blasting subjects, the switch box.
Oh, electric blasting.
Yeah.
Yeah. On electric blasting, you use the electric caps in your holes. And they were delays. We call them delays. They were electric wires on them. And they were different lengths from probably, I suppose, an inch to maybe about a 3-inch, 2.5-inch cap electric. And they were timed by that. I mean, the shorter ones would explode sooner than the longer ones had to burn farther to explode that. And after you drilled and blast and put in your electric delays, and then you would hook up to an electric lead wire that was run along the drift into the place. You'd hook on silver, red, and yellow. I think the colors were all your reds on one, all your yellow wires on the other wire. It's like a house. If you put the wires there, nothing would happen. You short out. But you put all them wires on one, and all the wires on the other one. If you had a lot of wires, you'd skin the lead wire back foot or so, and then put your wires on each one of those. So you don't have too many wires on one side. Well, anyway, this wire then went down to a blasting. Sometimes it went further. You hooked up to another real permanent electric wiring. And then that in turn went back to an electric box, like what you see in the house, got a handle on it, you know. How do you say? Box, electric, switch box, what I'm trying to say. Well, anyway, Miner had a key for that electric box. First of all, before you get ahead of the story, you got to make sure your places are all guarded. Nobody can walk into that blast. And when that's all set, then you walk back to the switch box. And in the switch box, there was a thing called a stinger. You open your box, and you take the stinger and push it up into a slot where that would go up into, and then throw your switch. Either that, or you could throw your switch and just jam the stinger up there enough to get the current, and then of course it was instant, boom, 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 and started going. Now, that was safe. That was electric blasting. It was pretty foolproof. There have been cases, a few, where you had a You had a poor cat, maybe sometimes it would just rupture. It wouldn't explode, you know. It would just rupture a little bit. It had to have 65-pound pressure to set that dynamite off. When that cap exploded, it was 65-pound bang, you know, hit. But now and again, they would run into one faulty cap where it wouldn't really explode. It would just poof out and just rupture the cap. It wouldn't really explode the cap. But that was rare. That was rare. Overall, you figure all the thousands and hundreds of thousands of electric fuses, caps. Very little problem. Very little problem.
Okay, we're going to change to a little slightly different topic. You mentioned in your early years in the mines there were a lot of foreigners.
Oh, sure.
Tell me about that.
Yes, it was interesting to work with a lot of them old people. Like I told you about little Frank. They had different ways of saying things. And
tell me a little bit about Frank in case we don't have him on tape. This is Frank Gazzetti we were talking
about.
Yeah,
he's been gone for quite a few years now. He was 90-some when he passed away. Yeah. I gotta stop and think here a little bit. Another little thing about the mine here now, about little Frank. I was a shift boss for a few years. I didn't care too much about shift bossing, but I was. And where they were supposed to start their mill raise, when I come in the place, little Frank would come and say, he said, "What place we start the milk?" Instead of, you know, where do we start the next mill? What place we start the milk? I get kicked out of him. Yeah.
What, you mentioned different people of different nationalities when you first started in the mines. What nationalities were they?
Well, looking back when I started, I think it was predominantly Finnish and Italians. Yeah, and of course English, Swedish, Norwegian. Yeah, I didn't know, not Princeton, maybe it might have been one or two French, but no, it was mostly Finnish, Italian, English, and Swedish. Yeah.
Were they all English speaking, or did some of them still speak?
No, they spoke broken. They spoke broken English. You could understand them. But a lot of times, of course, you had to listen a little bit to what they're talking about. We're getting back away from the mine level. We repaired our hunting camp in 1941. And I worked with an old Finnish fellow, Dave Heitinen from Gwynn. He was in the same camp as Dad. I remember one time he told me, he couldn't say Glenn either, he said Lint. "Hey Lint, go get wassels." You said, "What then?" "Go get wassels." Wassels? I couldn't say that. "Wassels, wassels, you gotta go and show me you want some washers." Wassels. Yeah.
Do you recall with the ethnic mix of people, was there a lot of prejudice about among different groups, one to the other, or were there taboos about people, you know, Frenchmen marrying Finns or anything like that?
Well, sure, you bet. Back then, you bet that there was that. Yeah. More so, now it isn't so much. Even marrying religions mixing, they wanted to marry some of your own kind. You know. Yes, I remember Dad telling the story even when he married a cousin Jack or cousin Ginny. He said his mother cried, and he figured he should have had somebody who was Swedish too. You know, so yeah, and they felt more of that those days. Mm-hmm. And I guess around Gwynn, Princeton, especially, I guess there was a lot of fighting between the Finnish and the Italian. Yeah, they didn't get along too good. Well, they got along, I suppose, but there was more friction, I suppose, a little more friction. You don't find that so much no more. And I didn't feel it in the mind. I didn't feel it when I started either, and I didn't feel that. Everybody got along good, even them old Finns and Italians and whatever. They all got along good.
You started to talk about Gwyn just a little bit, and I think you wanted me to ask you about a well in Gwyn.
Oh, yeah, the Kidder Shaft. That's right near town. In fact, when you cross the bridge going to New Swansea, there's a road turns to the right that goes to Johnson Lake. You've probably been there. And you can see their water tank on the right side there. That was put down under air pressure down to ledge. I don't know, it's 300 feet or something down the ledge going down through quicksand, sand. And they capped it. They went down with another shaft a little bit west of that, Gwyn Mine. It's called the Gwyn Mine. That operated. But they figured there was too much water in this, pretty well saturated in this one area. So they capped it. Gwyn at that time was getting the water from the Escanaba River pumping station up at Princeton for drinking water and for everything. Sometimes in the fall when the leaves are coming, you think you're drinking root beer. They're so brown. And so old Mr. Mather, or not Mather, but G.R. Jackson, he was the head of the superintendent of the Gwyn District at the time. And I suppose it was okayed by Mr. Mather too, but Mr. Jackson said, we got to get a good water supply for Gwyn, drinking water. So he said, suggested, and they did go ahead with uncapping the Kidder Shaft. It was called the Kidder Shaft. It would have been the Kidder Mine had it went. But anyway, they opened it up and built a raft and put a raft in there's a circular cement under air pressure, a circular cement shaft. Foundation company from New York put that shaft in. But they built a raft and put it in there. And then the men went down as they were pumping. They pumped a lot of water. And as the raft was going down, and this was over a period of weeks, you know, many, many weeks. As they were going down slowly, the men had scrub brushes on a handle. They were scrubbing them walls, you know, clean it up good. And they scrubbed those walls until the water, you couldn't pump anymore. It would hold its own pretty much. There was so much water. But anyway, they went down that far cleaning it. And then when they got down there, they drilled 25 well points through the cement. And with regulators on them, and they could shut off from up on surface the amount of flow coming into there. It was a tremendous amount of water in that area. Tremendous. Well, the Gwyn had a beautiful water supply. Clear, cold water. Real good water. So Mr. Jackson had to do with getting that. Yeah.
What year would this have been?
It was in the 30s. I don't know. I suppose that'd be 36, 7 in there sometime, someplace. Yeah, in fact, well, Mr. Jackson was the one that got, I guess, pushed hard to get that Princeton mine going again for the war effort. Because he was a kind of a big kingpin down there in the Gwyn District when they were really going. Yeah.
How do you know the story of the well?
My father. But of course, I was that age, I knew what was going on there too. See? 10, 12 years old, you know, 13. Yeah.
Did you ever go and watch, or would they let anybody come in there?
Well, you could go, not right up to it, but yeah, I remember. And they dug the pipeline even by hand. They didn't have no backhoes in that, don't they? Guys were in there mucking out to lay the pipe. Dig by hand with shovel, you know. Of course, I know what that is, too. I got water there, too. Not if he's one. Yeah. Oh, sure. A lot of those shafts in the Gwyn District were put down under air pressure. Quite a few of them, Roger Mackin and Francis, Kidder. Yeah, they were all put down under air pressure. But
I think I told you my grandfather Diamond drilled for that Francis mine out in the middle of the lake, Johnson Lake. With them old steam, big steam drill, big boil, you know. But they had them high off the ice, so they wouldn't melt the ice. And yeah, that was all interesting to me. And the Stevenson mine was a big producer, a good grade ore too, but that flooded out too. And they managed to pump it out. And they resumed operations. And they finally, Barnes Sector went down, 26, then they shut the Stevenson in 27. They didn't want another Barnes Sector. Yeah, so it flooded once and they pumped it out and resumed operation until that happened up there, and they figured, I suppose that's it. Yeah.